I think, in the sense that has he done every single thing? Has he pulled out every stop? Has he called every member? Has he tweaked every tweak? Has he done every single thing he can possibly and used every minute of every day that's possible to get this thing through? Then the answer is yes. Has the team put everything out there? Have we left everything on the field? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, this isn't a dictatorship, and we've got to expect members to ultimately vote to, you know, how they will according to what they think. But I think they're, as the president made clear, they're the ones who have to go back and answer to their constituents why they didn't fulfill a pledge that they made.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer today on President Trump's push to get the American Health Care Act passed. That's the GOP replacement for Obamacare. It is headed to a vote today. Whether it can pass the House is a big question. Just one of many big questions tackled by lawmakers and the president this week. There's also the investigation into the Trump team's ties to Russia, and the president's pick for the Supreme Court could face a Democratic filibuster. For more on these stories and more, we're joined by Van Newkirk. He covers politics and policy for The Atlantic. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi, Madeline.
And Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Reuters. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Well, let us start with the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Van Spicer seemed to say today that if it doesn't pass, the president is moving on. And last night, the president called for a vote to take place today. Is this a strong arm tactic, a negotiation tactic, perhaps from the art of the deal? Or is the effort to repeal and replace, is it really done if this vote fails?
I think the Trump White House believes it's a strong arm tactic, and they think it's going to work that way. But traditionally, historically, you know, I don't think this sort of arm twisting from the White House has really garnered the type of results they've wanted. In this case, it looks like there may be, especially now that we know, now that there's been reports that people in the White House are thinking about holding on to the names of no votes as, you know, in order for retribution and things like that. They're setting up the stage for, say, we do have the vote in an hour or so. There might be mass defections against it, because who's going to vote for it then? You know, I think people are going to vote no because they know the vote is going, the bill's going down now, and nobody wants to vote for failed major legislation.
So why hold the vote at all? Why not pull it?
Well, I think what Ryan wants to do is to not hold it. I think on the Congress side, the people who actually know how this works and who've been in Congress for years, the general consensus is, why are we holding this vote? But I think the Trump White House really wants, there are two outcomes here. Either some miracle and they do pass it, or they don't, and the administration gets to sort of blame the dysfunction on people in Congress and not Trump. Trump can come to the American people and say, well, you know, I tried to give you this thing and this amazing thing I promised, the greatest health care plan ever that I promised you, but Congress got in the way. And that's political ammunition for him.
Even though this was Paul Ryan's plan, this was the Republicans' plan, pretty much, and he just signed on to it, the president.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, right? And I think people in the White House actually advised him against initially signing on as a thing he endorsed right away, but he did, and now here we are.
And so, just to be clear, there is no plan B from either the White House or the Republicans?
I don't know that there's one right now. I'm sure there's some ideas percolating around in the Senate, and, you know, it is a reconciliation bill, so Senate's still free to produce a bill that would probably be more moderate, but I don't see any coherent, cohesive ideas coming together in either branch right now.
So how big of a political fail would this be if it doesn't pass for Trump and for the Republicans?
Well, if they don't vote, they can always do the, you know, they can kick the can and they can say, we're going to work on something else, or we're going to make this better. So I think a no vote is actually not that damaging. But if they do vote, and especially if they vote and there's mass defection against it, if you lose the whole Freedom Caucus and members of the moderate Republicans, that looks really bad. And, you know, right now, I think the bill has a 17% approval rating among Americans. This is a thing that's entirely foreseeable. And some of the problems in the bill were things that I think even the most basic neophyte policy-minded people could have foreseen from the start. And so it does look really bad if there's a massive vote against this instead of just, you know, pushing it or postponing it or delaying it indefinitely.
Okay, let's move on to another big political story this week, and that is the hearings. There were hearings at the start of the week looking into the Trump team's ties to Russia. Jonathan Landay, there was news made earlier today when Devin Nunes, head of the House Intelligence Committee, spoke to reporters, and he said what exactly?
Well, there are a number of things he said. First of all, he said he's canceling a hearing that had been scheduled for March 28th, at which former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, the former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and former CIA Director John Brennan had agreed to testify. He also said that Mr. Manafort, Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager who had ties to the former pro-Russia administration of Ukraine, has voluntarily agreed to come before the committee and testify. But for me, the most interesting thing that he said was he appears to have retreated from an assertion he made earlier this week that some kind of documents that he has reviewed, some kind of intelligence reports, showed that the president-elect, that Donald Trump, after the election, and his team were at least monitored and their names disseminated within the intelligence community. Today, he appears to have backed down from that, saying he can't be sure whether these conversations were among Trump or his aides were captured in surveillance were actually discussions between them, because they may well have been discussions between foreigners who were being monitored by the National Security Agency under special warrants, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants. And so that, of course, prompted a harsh response from the senior Democrat on the committee, who was angry about the fact that they've canceled this hearing, and more importantly, appeared to see, and this would be Adam Schiff, mm-hmm. Democrat from California, who appeared to suggest at one point that perhaps Mr. Nunes' revelations or alleged revelations that he's made over the last week may have been somehow coordinated with the White House. He appeared to have called for Mr. Nunes to be removed from the chairmanship of the committee for playing what he contends are politics with the investigation into alleged ties between Trump campaign and Russia, and accused his Republican chairman of attempting to, quote, choke off public information on this whole matter.
Yeah, so quite dramatic. We actually have a clip of tape of Adam Schiff making that assertion today.
There must have been a very strong pushback from the White House about the nature of Monday's hearing. It's hard for me to come to any other conclusion about why an agreed-upon hearing would be suddenly canceled. Clearly, it had to do with the events of this week. The chairman himself said that the cancellation of the hearing had nothing to do with these documents that he saw. So we know that was not the issue. So what other explanation can there be? There really is none.
Okay, so he's referring to this hearing you mentioned where Sally Yates, former DNI director James Clapper, and John Brennan.
No, the one he's actually referring to is the one from earlier this week at which the current director of the FBI, James Comey, confirmed.
Right, but the canceled one, have been with Sally Yates, James
Indeed.
Clapper, and John Brennan, former head of the CIA. And he's suggesting that the White House didn't like the hearing that took place on Monday, right, with James Comey.
Right.
And Mike Rogers.
Yeah, right, at which Comey confirmed that there is a counterintelligence investigation into whether or not there were these ties between the Trump campaign, members of the Trump campaign, and Russia.
Right. And so basically, Adam Schiff is saying he's hinting strongly that he doesn't have any faith that Devin Nunes can run an impartial inquiry.
Absolutely. He repeated that today. He's been saying that since Nunez made his comments earlier this week in his first two news conferences about this. And it's interesting in that you now have senior Republicans in the Senate, and I'm talking about John McCain, who's now saying he doesn't have confidence that Congress can conduct an impartial investigation, and he wants to see some kind of bipartisan congressional investigation into this. He hasn't come as far as a lot of the Democrats, who are calling for either a special prosecutor or an independent commission a la the 9/11 commission.
Okay. And finally, as if this wasn't dramatic enough, we have the 3 days of hearings for Neil Gorsuch, the president's nominee to be on the Supreme Court. Dahlia, I haven't forgotten about you. Tell us, what did we learn about Neil Gorsuch over those 3 days?
Stop and consider, Madeline, that this is the seventh most interesting thing that happened on Capitol Hill this week. What we learned about Judge Gorsuch was no big surprises. I think he is incredibly affable and warm and well-loved. He's very, very smart, very charming. He actually said less about doctrine, about precedent, about cases that have been decided than almost anyone who's ever testified. And let me be clear, the bar's really low. What most of the, in the sort of very recent history, post-Bork confirmation hearing history, it's been a tradition to say very, very little about precedent and case law. I think Gorsuch said even less. So we actually know almost nothing about where his head is on legal questions. But I think if the issue was his character, he came off very well.
Okay. And so despite that, you have Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader, saying that he's not going to vote yes. He'll vote against confirmation and urging other Democrats to do the same. Do you expect a filibuster?
Yeah, Schumer has announced that they're going to filibuster, and we've heard back from McCain and Senate Republicans that if they try to filibuster, Republicans will exercise the nuclear option, and there will no longer be a filibuster. So I think in the brinksmanship that we've already described on this show, there is no place more you blink first than the U.S. Senate and the Judiciary Committee, because both sides have taken their most extreme positions, I think, by the end of this week.
But are the Democrats voting against Gorsuch because of Merrick Garland? Because for a year, Merrick Garland was not given a hearing. Is this payback, or do they have actual reservations about the nominee?
I think both. I think one of the things that was a little bit confusing about the hearing is that some of the senators, I'm thinking of Patrick Leahy, Dianne Feinstein, Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, came in on the assumption that, look, you know, a grave injustice was done, and all the things that you can say that are nice and wonderful about Neil Gorsuch, you could have said equally about Merrick Garland, except you didn't give him a hearing, so we have a problem. I think there were other senators, I'm thinking of Amy Klobuchar, Chris Coons on the committee, who were more apt to do this on the merits and just say, is this person kind of outside the mainstream? Is this someone I could live with? So I don't think that there's one or the other. I think that it's and. And I think the combination of Gorsuch being awfully evasive on some really important issues, plus this question of, you know, how is it possible that you denied Obama's nominee a hearing for hundreds of days, plus I think the added anxiety Elizabeth Warren has put this towards, saying how can a president who is under a cloud of FBI investigation possibly put up a lifetime nominee to the Supreme Court. So I think some kind of combination of all those factors are making it easier for Democrats to filibuster somebody who otherwise, you know, had Jeb Bush put him up, would have probably sailed through.
So if there is the nuclear option and, you know, that goes ahead, then that means that Gorsuch will finally take his seat on the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it means, I mean, he needs 52 votes. He's got their 52 Republicans. I think that if they do away with the filibuster, then he will take his seat. It's probably worth pointing out that Mitch McConnell is not really wanting to pull the trigger on the nuclear option, it really does do away with one of the great old storied traditions in the Senate and a mechanism to kind of cool things down a little bit. So I think that we're still hearing talk of backroom deals whereby Democrats agree not to filibuster and Republicans agree to let them go ahead with the next seat, which is much more worrisome, I think, to Democrats, is what happens when Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Anthony Kennedy steps down. And, the real kind of three-dimensional chess game here isn't replacing Antonin Scalia with another person who is functionally like Antonin Scalia. It's what happens at the next, when the next person steps down and the entire balance at the court shifts. So they're not just playing for keeps around this one. I think they're thinking, how do I game out the one that's coming down the pike?
All right. We have run out of time. I'm sure we could keep on going with talk of this interesting week. Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. We also heard from Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Reuters, and Van Newkirk, who covers politics and policy for The Atlantic. Thank you all. And we want to hear from you. Do you want to comment on this week? Do you want to comment on the week in politics or on the bill to replace the ACA, on the Gorsuch confirmation hearings, on the investigation into the Trump team and Russia? Do you just want to vent? You can weigh in on our Facebook page or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why the LA County Sheriff is against making California a sanctuary state. We'll ask him why next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA County Sheriff Jim McDonnell has come out against a bill that would make California a sanctuary state. It's called the California Values Act, or Senate Bill 54, and it would bar state and local police from helping federal immigration officials detain undocumented immigrants. It's moved to the full state Senate for a vote. Sheriff McDonnell says the bill would hinder the work of his agency and force ICE agents into communities. And Sheriff McDonnell joins me now. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, L.A. has the largest sheriff's department and the biggest jail system in the country. And I understand that ICE agents can now go inside the jails every day. To what extent have you been working with ICE?
Yeah, ICE has access like any other federal agency or any other police agency would have to our jails, no more than anyone else would have. We are governed by the Truth Act and the Trust Act, both California state laws that determine which crimes are eligible for ICE to have an interview with that individual and then for them to do whatever follow-up they're going to do.
And what crimes are they?
Yeah, that delineates. They're delineated in the penal code, but it's basically serious and violent crimes. The concern there is about insignificant crimes or the lower-level crimes being people being caught up in that. That's addressed by the Trust Act. So I think we feel like we're in pretty good shape as having a best practice of low-level offenders not being swept up in ICE enforcement, but those that have significant crimes, those that potentially would be released and go back to prey on the community, those are the people that ICE is focused on and the people that the state law allows ICE to have access to.
Would that include, Sheriff, gang affiliation?
It depends on the crime. It's more based on crime than gang affiliation. It's more, as far as I know, delineated by, say, robbery, burglary, rape, murder, the straight penal code crime, as opposed to gang affiliation.
So what is wrong with this SB 54 proposed law that Senate leader Kevin DeLeon has introduced? You wrote in a letter to him that safety would be compromised.
Yeah, my concern there is that if ICE is not given access under the Trust Act, under the Truth Act, to violent or serious criminals within the custody environment, then they're still going to try and do their job, and they're going to then go into the communities, which is not something that is certainly desirable, I think, by anybody who looks at this, to be able to arrest the target. And the chances of them, I think, limiting their arrest to the actual target if they're in the company of others who may be also undocumented is problematic. They're more likely to take the targeted individual and then others in that environment, which for us creates a level of distrust within the community. We're all looked upon as the police, And we've worked very hard to build a foundation of trust with our immigrant communities, with all of the communities that we serve. And the fear is that this would be eroded if ICE is not given access to the individuals in the environment that's a controlled environment where they know the target and they're able to take the target into custody if that's what they choose to do.
But there are reports now, Sheriff, of ICE agents operating in the community, of showing up at schools, of showing up outside courthouses. And there are many anecdotal reports of people too afraid to go about their daily business in the community for fear that they might be picked up by an ICE agent.
Yeah. Now, the level of anxiety is high, and we're trying to work with groups in the community to be able to allay that, to let them know very clearly that the LA County Sheriff's Department, police agencies, local police agencies in Southern California do not participate in immigration enforcement. Nobody will be stopped to determine their immigration status. That's not what we do. That is a function of the federal government. That is the responsibility of ICE. ICE, in any case, would not be controlled or guided by the Senate bill because they're federal agents and that's a state law. They would continue to do their job. The fact that they are making arrests, as we've heard reports of, that wouldn't change if Senate Bill 54 was put into effect either. They would still do whatever they feel they need to do to complete their mission. Our hope is that we can work with ICE in a way that we can put the anxieties at ease. We can work in a way that's constructive, where people feel comfortable coming forward if they're a victim of a crime, a witness to a crime, and we don't have the situation that so many are so very concerned about now, and understandably.
A report came out this week that fewer people are reporting sex assaults because they're afraid of being reported to immigration authorities.
We looked at that on our side, and we're not seeing the same correlation. In fact, our radio calls in the areas that where we have the largest immigrant populations are actually up. I talked to our detectives in Special Victims Bureau as it related to the sexual assault question, and they have not seen any decrease in the numbers of crimes being reported. So we'll continue to dig into that. I know anecdotally it is an issue, but we don't have the stats to support that happening in the county area, at least at this point.
Are you worried about losing federal funding if the state of California becomes a sanctuary state?
You know, that's always a concern. We need resources to be able to do the job as well as it can be done. But that has not been one of the concerns that I have focused on. I'm focused primarily on, having the trust of the communities that we serve. Trust is our currency, if you will. And if we don't have that, we can't do the job the way it needs to be done, the way the public deserves it to be done.
So some groups have come out against your opposition to this sanctuary bill. The legal director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network has been quoted as saying it is pretty unfortunate that you appear to be siding with the Trump administration in opposition to the most important human rights bill of a generation.
Yeah, I saw that. And I think there's a misunderstanding there, because if you look at yesterday or the day before yesterday, the Trump administration put out their report from ICE of departments across the country that they did not feel were satisfactorily working with ICE on detainer requests. And again, a complicated, very nuanced issue, but there is a case law from Oregon that says that we cannot hold somebody beyond the time they would normally be released pursuant to what is, in essence, an administrative request from ICE to hold somebody. It would have to be a warrant for us to do that. Really, what we're trying to do is protect everybody in every community that we serve as best we can, and trying to strike that balance between public trust and public safety.
So you said that it's vital that you have cooperation from immigrant communities in terms of solving crimes. Have you noticed a drop-off in that cooperation lately?
We haven't, but we've also been working very hard so that we don't have a drop-off. We're trying to get out and speak before every community group we can to be able to let people know what our role is, the fact that we are not an arm of immigration. We do not stop people to determine their immigration status. We need people to work with us. And so we've tried to be as clear as we can on that. And I hope that we can continue to maintain that trust and be able to get out in a larger forum to be able to put people's anxieties to rest and let them know that we're here to protect them. And if we work together, we can be successful. And if people are anxious about coming forward, then it's detrimental to everybody.
Kevin De Leon amended the bill so that the FBI would get a 60-day notice of when violent felons are released from prisons or jails. Would that satisfy your concern?
No, there's a number of issues there. When you look at our jail population in Los Angeles, we're holding some people as little as 20% of their sentence time. And so to put a cap on it for 60 days or any determinant like that, I think would be something we'd look at to see if we can make it work. But I'm not sure what that would satisfy as opposed to doing it the way we're doing it under the Trust Act.
Well, I guess notifying the FBI rather than ICE.
Yeah, what are they going to do? The FBI is going to notify ICE, right? I would think.
And some advocates have said, look, the problem is actually at the point of arrest, that when officers make an arrest, that is when immigrants, undocumented immigrants, are put in jeopardy. And so if they're arrested for a minor traffic violation or if there's a misidentification of their identity or something like that, and they are processed in the system and then come to the attention of ICE, that's where the real problem is. It's at the point of arrest. Are you looking at that and possibly instructing your officers to change your priorities when it comes to who you pull over, who you arrest?
No, I mean, we pull people over not based on any immigration status or perceived immigration status. It's based on a violation of the law and the investigation pursuant to that. Our capacity issues are such that when you look at county jail today in Los Angeles, we're holding primarily serious felons throughout our system. And on an average daily basis, we have 16,500 to 17,000 inmates across the system. So we're doing the best we can, from a triage standpoint, to be able to hold those who need to stay in and cite those out to the community with an appearance for court for those that we feel we can do that with.
And finally, there have been some reports that ICE agents are identifying themselves as police officers. And that's one of the reasons why there's some confusion in communities. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to ICE about that, about not doing that?
Well, we have a meeting this coming week with officials from ICE, so that'll be one of the topics of discussion. That confusion is problematic for us, but also one that they're concerned about from their own safety, that they need to identify themselves clearly, that when they stop somebody, it's a legitimate stop. So we'll work through that with them as best we can to be able to come up with something that is very clear to the community and also then hopefully affords them the protection they need to do their job.
Jim McDonald, LA County Sheriff, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up on the program, new movie reviews, and this week, aliens, chips, and superheroes who love Krispy Kreme donuts.
It's essentially like Superhero Breakfast Club. You have these five kids who are all high school students, who are each of them is a type. They meet in detention.
Should you? Go, go, Power Rangers. Movie reviews up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so that means it's time to talk about new movies. This week, surprise, surprise, another ride on the nostalgia train. Here to talk about new releases is Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and film critic for The New Republic. Hi.
Hi there.
And joining us back in her seat, Christy Lemire, host of What the Flick on YouTube. She also reviews films for RogerEbert.com. Hi.
Hello.
Let us start with the big A-lister new release. It's called Life. Unpretentiously, and it stars Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal.
We're looking at the first proof of life beyond Earth.
You're finally a daddy.
It's gonna be a big custody battle over this one.
That's beautiful.
You!
Okay, Christy, this new life, doesn't like its daddy.
No, it's very adorable and lovely and sweet at first, and then it turns into an alien monster. I mean, this is Alien. It is.
It's Oedipus Rex.
It's very derivative, but it does what it does so well that I was into it the whole way through. It is gripping. It is lean. It is efficient. It's got this great cast, and although you have serious superstars in it with Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal, it does very much feel like an ensemble, and you do not necessarily know what is going to happen to these people based on who plays them. I will say that there are surprises to be had. The visual effects are very cool. The sound design is very evocative. The noises that this creature makes as it gets bigger and more menacing is very cool. I liked it. It worked for me, even though I knew what it was.
So it's Alien.
Yeah, it's Alien. And I totally agree with Christy. I mean, it is the movie that you thought it was, and it's a fine version of that movie. What I think also is fun is I think Rebecca Ferguson, who's not as big as Gyllenhaal and Reynolds, this is the best thing that she's done since the last Mission Impossible movie, which is sort of her big breakthrough moment, I feel like. And it's just sort of a really fun B movie that I feel like Hollywood doesn't make much anymore. They kind of make the big tent poles, and that's mm-hmm. kind of about it. And this is just sort of like fun junk food. And I say that with entire appreciation.
But when I think B movie, I think campy and fun.
But this is not campy.
Yeah. I think what's fun about this is it doesn't wink. It doesn't, I mean, even though it's clearly an Alien ripoff and it references like 2001 and Gravity and all these different types of sci-fi movies, it's kind of like the Alien itself, honestly. It just kind of does its thing and kind of goes from point to point to point really, really effectively. There's some fun twists. I think the ending is really well done without saying anything. I had a fine time watching this. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. I love the final shot of it. It is very intense. The final shot is beautiful, but it's shot really well from the very beginning. There's a very, very long tracking shot as you follow one astronaut after another as they're all floating from one room to another on this space station. And it gets you very efficiently into this place, who they are, and it's a better made movie than you might expect it to be.
So a lot of critics who liked Arrival said that this was kind of a new space movie where you have more philosophical thoughts, feelings, shall we say, for alien life form,
right,
that they're not out to get us necessarily, but to teach us a good life lesson. This is not that.
No, there are no philosophical thoughts in this movie. It just goes about its business, yeah.
Okay, it goes about its business. All right. Speaking of business, let's get to the next movie. This one is different. It's a reboot of an old TV favorite. Here's a clip from Chips.
This job is crucial. Without us out there,
come on,
someone could get hurt.
California Highway Patrol think they have some crooked cops. They want you to go on the inside.
Go undercover within the department? That's awesome.
We put you with a rookie named John Baker.
So who am I playing?
Francis Llewellyn Poncherello.
Are the first two female names?
Oh, John and Ponch. I remember them when they were cruising the highways back in the day. So is this worthy of a remake?
This movie is stupid and sophomoric and juvenile and really, really, really dumb. I did laugh a decent amount, I have to admit, at this movie. I wouldn't say I recommend it, but I have to say it is very much a buddy cop movie. It is very much a what if 21 Jump Street had dumber, hornier characters. It is sort of like that. It's a bit of a mess. The whole movie is a bit of a mess. Dax Shepard, who wrote and directed it, who also stars in it with Michael Pena, the two of them have, I think, really fun chemistry in the film. You know, it's sort of like dumb guy one and dumb guy two. I wouldn't say I ultimately liked it, but it's a movie I will say I laughed a lot and was sort of embarrassed by how much I laughed at the dumb stuff in this movie.
Christy, just looking at the preview, there seemed to be a lot of gay jokes, which mm-hmm. seems to underscore the sophomoric point of view that Tim has just expressed.
Yeah, this movie is dumb, but it also really doesn't bear much resemblance to the actual Chips TV show. I watched a lot of Chips as a kid. You have characters named Ponch and John, and they ride motorcycles on the freeways of Los Angeles, and that is about the only thing this movie has in common with the TV show. People are actually mad about this movie, by the way. Chips aficionados, and
really?
They are out there. Are mad about this. This movie hates women. And I am not super offended by anything, but every single woman in this movie is either like horny, oversexed, or she's a shrew. You know who gets it worst of all is Dax Shepard's real life wife, Kristen Bell. I don't know why she signed on for this, but she plays Dax Shepard's ex-wife or soon-to-be ex-wife in this movie, and she has left him for Josh Duhamel, because who wouldn't? I would. And but she is horrible and opportunistic and vapid, and but not even in a funny way, not in a well-drawn way.
You kind of wonder what they're talking about off-screen when they go home.
I just wonder why she said yes to this. I mean, she doesn't need the work. She's Anna in the Frozen movie. She gets plenty of work. She's very likable. I went and saw this last night at an actual theater with actual people, and people were laughing all around me. I laughed here and there. I guess they have some decent chemistry, but it's in the service of just idiocy and gay panic. And it's just so, it's done. It's lame. Like, why are gay panic jokes still funny? I don't know.
Okay, let's move on then, because there really isn't anything else to say about that. A new movie starring Woody Harrelson as a miserable misanthrope. Here's a clip from Wilson.
Life is lonely and miserable.
You are such a beautiful girl.
Hey, dude. Wilson, she needs to leave.
My wife left me 17 years ago.
What is in there?
I just need to move on, find somebody new. Not you necessarily.
Okay, sounds like a thoroughly dislikable person. Do you want to spend 2 hours with him, Tim?
I wish I hadn't. this is based on the Daniel Clowes graphic novel. He wrote the screenplay for this. It's directed by Craig Johnson, who made The Skeleton Twins a couple years ago, which I thought was really good. This movie is not necessarily terrible, but it's just, you know what the movie is from the beginning. Woody Harrelson plays Wilson, a middle-aged curmudgeon who hates life and likes to sort of impose his misanthropic view of the world on everybody around him. But don't worry, because he's going to learn valuable lessons about connecting with other people and sort of forgiving people for the mistakes they've made in the past.
Is there a plot to talk about?
Basically, he reconnects with his ex-wife, played by Laura Dern. What he finds out is that about 17 years ago, she birthed his child that he had no idea about. So the two of them are going to reconnect with this now teenage daughter. So it's very much in the crumb happiness, mm-hmm. you know, sort of that kind of world of misanthropes who end up kind of having a heart of gold at the end. I just found the movie intermittently funny. I usually enjoy Woody Harrelson and he can play kind of like this grumpy, cranky kind of guy pretty well. I think Laura Dern's really fun in this movie as his ex-wife. And I just feel like this is a movie we've seen over and over again. Alexander Payne was supposed to direct this a few years ago. And I have to admit, I kind of wish to see what that version would have been like, because I feel like maybe Alexander Payne could have brought more dimensions to this movie. It just feels like a straight line. I'm not sure if anybody in America needs to see any more movies about middle-aged white guys.
Grumpy middle-aged white guys who need to learn a lesson.
Who are grumpy and will eventually like realize, oh, people are okay.
Okay, we have enough of that in real life.
Yes.
Okay. All right, finally, let's move on to another TV show remade for the big screen, a reboot of Power Rangers. Here's a clip.
Do you feel weird?
We're strong.
Insanely strong.
The answer to what is happening to you is here. You five are the Power Rangers.
Did I just hear you say we're Power Rangers?
Is this some kind of joke?
Is it, Christy?
I wish. It is not. So while I am old enough to be well-versed in Chips, I am too old to know about Power Rangers. This was on TV, early 90s, I want to say. It was a cartoon. It's essentially like Superhero Breakfast Club. You have these five kids who are all high school students, each of them is a type. They meet in detention. I wish I were making that up,
no.
But they do. And then they go to this abandoned mine and they discover these little colorful power crystals, which give them superpowers. And it thrusts them into the midst of this millennia old battle for the planet. Elizabeth Banks is a former Power Ranger who has gone rogue and is now evil. And the tiny town of Angel Grove gets destroyed in the process. I guess if you liked the cartoon, it's very exciting to see all the characters that you know. And there were callbacks to the show, because I know this, because in my audience, people clapped at certain moments that I did not understand. And then they
played, old were those audience
I don't know,
members?
Younger than me. And so and they also play the Power Rangers theme song at one point, and the whole place went nuts.
Oh.
So it's okay.
So it knows its audience.
Yeah. But having said that, I guess if you are young, if you are like a teenager, you'll dig it. I brought my son, and he's 7, and he was like, it's okay.
It was also live action in the 90s, right?
I don't know. There's various incarnations of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know this world at all, but apparently it used to be a Japanese series that they brought to America and essentially just like redubbed over parts of it. I hated this movie. I thought it was terrible. I thought it was really terrible. And Christy did not mention the most important thing, which is if you want a 30-minute long Krispy Kreme product placement in your filmed entertainment for the weekend, then Power Rangers is the movie for you. There's so much Krispy Kreme product placement. It is.
Is that what gives them their superpowers? Krispy Kreme donut? Because if so, I'm all in.
Sad.
I'm all in anyway.
No, that may be our origin story, but for the movie, not so much. No, I mean, this is a movie that makes you long for the sophistication of like Transformers and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
The Lego movie?
Yeah, I mean, the Lego movie is so far beyond what there's been some talk about the fact that this is the first movie to have an LGBTQ main character. There's also another one of the Power Rangers who is autistic. And I have to say that maybe I'm just so progressive on my own part that didn't even seem that revolutionary or interesting. I found all 5 of the Power Rangers to be deeply uninteresting. And the fact that they are told these are the people who are going to protect the Earth, I thought, oh, we really are screwed. It's Elizabeth Banks is so much fun. She kind of camps it up as the evil, witch or sorceress or whatever. She wears a lot of green in the movie. It's pretty terrible.
It's pretty terrible.
The only good part is that Bill Hader provides the voice of the robot who is like their trainer who explains this world to them. And Bill Hader is always funny. Elizabeth Banks is in a totally different movie, by the way. She's having a blast. Nobody else is.
Yes. I support the like side movie that she will do later. we're like spinoff they want to do with her name. Her character's name is Rita, which apparently is from the TV show.
Rita Repulsa.
That is not a name that's scary. I'm sorry. It's too late for Power Rangers to change that. Rita Repulsa does not strike fear into the heart of anyone.
It sounds more like a lounge singer.
Yeah. It's terrible. Did I mention it was terrible? It's a terrible movie.
I think all of the movies this week.
Life
was good.
Except for life. Okay.
Choose life.
Yes.
Choose life and not donuts.
Or anything else that we've mentioned today. Yes.
Okay. Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. She reviews films for RogerEbert.com, Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International, and a film critic for The New Republic. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have some breaking news now. The healthcare bill vote has been canceled for now. The president, Donald Trump, apparently called Speaker Paul Ryan just a few moments ago and asked him to pull the bill. And Ryan is expected to give a news conference next hour. We'll have more coverage on To the Point coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. Just before that, on this show, a little dessert before the main meal. We'll talk about how a reality show caused a political crisis in the African country of Angola. We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you were to list ways to start a political crisis in a corrupt Marxist country, American reality TV probably wouldn't be the first thing to come to mind. But that's exactly what happened, thanks to the unlikeliest of culprits.
Coming up on this special episode of Say Yes to the Dress.
I live for bling, but bling is expensive.
Yep. TLC's Say Yes to the Dress was the root of a massive corruption scandal in the African nation of Angola. It involved the daughter of a government official, 9 custom-made dresses, and the single biggest sales receipt in the history of the bridal shop at the center of that TV show. Willard Foxton is a TV producer based in London. He wrote about the scandal for The Spectator. That's a weekly British magazine. Welcome.
Hello there.
Hello. Well, let's talk about the bride in question. Her name is Nalia Diogo. Who is she?
She's the daughter of a sort of a very senior figure in the MPLA, which is the Revolutionary Marxist Movement, who fought the Angolan Civil War. Obviously her father being a sort of beret wearing, you know, Che Guevara type guerrilla fighter, his kind of illusion is that he's this man of the people. He shares the hardships of the working man. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's his daughter sort of dropping hundreds of thousands of dollars on super sparkly wedding dresses on Say Yes the Dress.
Okay, here's a little tape from that episode.
Now, Lila's first dress is for a wedding license signing ceremony where only the family attends. And the price of this dress is $30,000. This dress has thousands of hand-embroidered Swarovski crystals. Everything is made from a very special silk tulle.
Okay, so she also bought another wedding dress and six bridesmaids' dresses, a dress for her mom. And as we said, she spent about $200,000. So put that in context. What kind of money does this, what does this mean for Angola, which has fairly recently emerged from a long civil war?
It's a funny one, actually, because the thing about Angola is it's simultaneously a very poor and a very rich country. So Luanda, which is the capital, is actually one of the most expensive places to live in the world. And it's actually kind of very developed. But once you go outside of Luanda, it's incredibly poor. It has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. So in Luanda, $200,000 may not get you very far, but anywhere else in Angola it's an unimaginable sum of money.
You say Luanda is the most expensive city in the world?
It's certainly one of the places.
New York or London or Moscow?
It's definitely one of the most expensive places to go in the world. Like if you try to get a hotel room, it's incredibly expensive. And, you know, there's 5-star restaurants everywhere and, you know, sort of contracts to do anything there are priced in millions and millions of dollars. So it isn't Angola. It's not as simple as Angola is this sort of war torn hellhole that it was about 30 years ago. It's certainly the cities are very developed. So it's a little bit more nuanced than maybe, you know, it first looks.
That's interesting. What's the source of the wealth?
It's what a lot of UN experts call the resource curse, whereby there's a lot of mineral wealth in the country, a lot of oil. And essentially, yeah, if you're in the right place at the right time, you can make an absolute killing by selling the mineral rights anywhere in the world.
So did we find out more about the source of the money behind the father, Bornito, is it D'Souza? Is that how you say his name?
I believe so. I wouldn't swear
minister.
To it.
So is he? So well, did he make his money in mineral wealth?
Well, he always claimed to be, you know, completely squeaky clean and, you know, a man of the people. He sort of only took his government salary. He wasn't one of these people kind of jetting around the world. He used to put out that he lived a humble lifestyle and all this kind of thing. He was a real sort of hero out there. And then obviously when his daughter's just laying the money out left, right and center on Say Yes to the Dress, with people sort of fawning over her in a New York bridal salon, people went crazy about it.
Did she think that no one would see this episode at home?
I think that it never even crossed their mind that this would air in Angola, that anyone would care about it. I think, to be honest with you, nobody expected it for anyone to notice. But even if they did notice, I don't think anyone thought they'd be upset.
So what happened?
Well, I mean, the episode went out in the States and no one really noticed. And then as soon as it went up on YouTube, then very shortly afterwards, there were protests, big protests in Angola. People were absolutely furious. And it was in many ways, it was sort of the spark. You know, there'd been a lot of discontent in Angola about sort of government ministers profiteering and so on and so forth. So it was sort of almost the spark that lit the tinderbox, really. But it's... it's really damaged her father. I mean, he hasn't lost his job, which is he's sort of the minister for colonial administration or something like that. But he hasn't lost his job. But definitely he was a front runner to be the next president in Angola. And it's completely cost him his ability to be president of Angola. So I hope the wedding dress was really, really nice.
Well, she did say yes to the dress. Okay. Willard Foxton.
Yes to the dress, no to the presidency.
Exactly. Willard Foxton is a television producer based in London. Thanks for sharing that story with us. yes to the KCOW sweatshirt you're wearing.
Yeah, it's encrusted with Swarovski crystals.
Yeah, I can tell.
And my father, who is a dictator in Michigan, is going to be in trouble for this. Okay, so big news of the day.
Big news.
It was healthcare before they pulled the bill, and it is definitely healthcare now that they have pulled the bill. A lot of people weighing in on this. Most of the people are weighing in with a healthy dose of schadenfreude. Donald String says, I don't see how anyone with a degree of common sense can look at this bill and think it's going to do good for the average American. They must think we're stupid or something, or maybe not, because they pulled it. Mark Fegeler says, this is what happens when you create legislation behind closed doors and smugly expect everyone in your party to toe the line. Richard Patty says, 7 years of nothing, time wasted on multiple pre-peel votes and nothing, and now they want the Holy Grail instantly. Even a child of five would know better. Sounds like he maybe is a voter for repealing, but disagrees with the process. Stephen D. Warren on Facebook says, I am unsure how anyone who sees what they have proposed can refer to it as a healthcare plan. Good for them for pulling the bill. And Nizar Senesusi says, Republicans are vehemently opposed to Obamacare, but what are they for? When attempting to replace something, one must have a viable option. Trump care is dead on arrival. How many healthcare puns have you heard today?
So many.
I even made one earlier.
You did.
Healthy bit of schadenfreude. And I'm not sorry. You know, I'm not proud.
Dose, I think you said.
Healthy dose?
So there's a double pun there.
Yeah, it's not covered by insurance, though. So I'll be paying for it later.
Okay. Jillian Myers, have a great weekend.
You too.
Schadenfreude or not. And you too, have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.